Richard Martin's Wake Up Call podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
A very warm welcome to you all, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin at the Wake Up Call, and it is Friday, December the 11th, 2015. Well, after my recent foray into the world of driverless cars, I'm not quite finished with information pertaining thereto. So, just a little addendum to the world of driverless cars. Henry Ford was a smart guy, but he never did the math when he decided to put every American household on wheels. A century after the Model T, the world has a problem with cars. The US and China will consume about 40 million light vehicles in 2015, according to IHS. Globally, we're on track to hit 100 million vehicles in 2020. That's not a lot of cars. That's an ocean of cars, an inundation, wave after wave, breaking on the shores of the industrialized world. And yet, policymakers and common folk alike have been powerless against the siren song of the automobile. Even in the most car-blighted burg in the world, the toxic parking lot they call Beijing, the appetite for the automobile as status item, as luxury, as totem of personal mastery in a fragile post-colonial mindset is driving millions more into its smoggy embrace, despite limits on ownership and the government's rising alarm. The absurdity of our century-old ad hoc approach to mobility is captured in one statistic. The usage rate of automobiles in the United States is about 5%. For the remaining 95% of the time, 23 hours, our cars just sit there, a slow, awful cash burn, like condos at the beach. But what if, like condos, automobiles could be shared? It's one of life's first lessons, how to share toys, parents, rooms, feelings. But as little consumers grow into adults, they forget the joys of selflessness that's about to change. And I don't mean the collaborative consumerism we see all around us, peer-to-peer transportation like Uber, which is symbolic and transitional, lasting only until automation happens, at which point we can get rid of the webware. And by webware, I mean us. Within a generation, cars will be endowed with what's known as level 4 autonomy, full self-driving artificial intelligence for cars, which will not so much change the game as burn down the casino. Autonomy will make it possible for unmanned automobiles to be summoned via app to your location. And not just any passing tramp steamer, but exactly the vehicle you need for the occasion, cleared and fueled for as little or as long as you need. Offers may vary in your state. When you're done, poof, it will go away. You won't pay for the car, you pay for the miles, and only the miles. It's a whole new way to fly. Let's start small. Need a pickup for 3 weekends a year but don't want to pay for the other 49? Autonomy could make that happen easily without a visit to the dreaded U-Haul depot. Need a car to take mum to the doctors or fetch a spouse from the airport? A decade hence, major automakers and smaller players will be at each other's throats for the privilege of sending consumers' vehicle à la carte for a one-way trip, an afternoon, a weekend, a month. These transactions will move through the glowing bowels of your monthly credit accounts, and you won't even feel them. Americans will look back on pre-autonomy like the age of Casio calculators and DOS prompts. Remember cab drivers? Remember traffic jams? Remember when parents lived in dread that their children would die in a car accident? Death and major injury from traffic accidents will drop drastically. The automobile's other costs, decreased productivity, fuel burnt in uncoordinated traffic, will be swept away. Beyond the practical benefits, autonomous cars could contribute $1.3 trillion in annual savings to the U.S. economy alone. And that's according to Ravi Shankar, a Morgan Stanley analyst covering the U.S. auto business. Global savings? Somewhere in the neighborhood of $5.6 trillion. Well, I've talked about the shrinking mall world before, but it is getting critically serious, both from a retail point of view and from the vantage of increased unemployment in a service industry that has up to now been thriving. Austin, Texas's economy is strong and its population swelling, but the Highland Mall couldn't attract enough shoppers to stay afloat. Competition came up and killed it, said Matt Whalen, principal at developer Red Leaf Properties LLC, which is working with the college on the project. An era of relentless expansion for American shopping centres is coming to an end as a toxic brew of overbuilding, the rise of e-commerce, and a wave of retailer bankruptcies force landlords to reimagine once lucrative properties. Some owners are converting struggling malls into apartments, offices, and industrial space, while others are turning big chunks of retail space into parks and playgrounds to keep shoppers interested. According to Tony Ruggieri, who eliminated about 50,000 square feet of retail space to create an open-air plaza at West Manchester Town Centre in York, Pennsylvania, which reopened last year, you have to create an environment that people want to come to. By year end, there will be 48.3 square feet of retail space per person in the US, down from the record 49.8 set in 2009, and that's according to the CoStar real estate data firm. This year marks the sixth consecutive annual drop, and CoStar forecasts declines through at least 2020. The decline has affected most categories of retail real estate, including strip centres and convenience stores, local shopping centres, and large malls, according to data from the International Council of Shopping Centres, a trade group. It comes after decades of aggressive expansion. In all, the amount of retail square footage per person swelled by 54% between 1970 and 2009, according to the ICSC. Susan Malvi, a research director at CoStar, said, "The fact is that we built far too much." End of quote. The recession of 2007 to 2009 left many retailers vulnerable as shoppers reined in spending sharply and then only slowly loosened their purse strings in the years since. Only one mall with at least 1 million square feet of leasable space has opened in the US since 2008, according to Green Street Advisors, which tracks retail real estate. By contrast, over the decade ending in 2005, 54 such properties were built. According to Greg Maloney, chief executive for retail in the Americas at real estate firm Jones Lang LaSalle, "We woke up one day and Circuit City was gone. The pain has continued through this year with Radio Shack Corp, American Apparel and Wet Sea Link, all seeking bankruptcy protection." End of quote. Online shopping, meanwhile, has more than doubled its share of all sales, from 3.6% in the third quarter of 2008 to 7.4% in the same period this year, according to Census Bureau figures. E-commerce is growing at a 15% annual clip, the most recent government data show taking another bite out of the property market. The weak bricks and mortar shopping climate is forcing landlords to think outside the big box. Terry Montesi, founder of Trademark Property Co., left a grove of oak trees in the middle of a development called Waterside he's building in Fort Worth, Texas, which will include a Whole Foods market and an REI store, as well as apartments and office space. The decision meant giving up about 20,000 square feet of retail space, but allowed him to link a public area around the oak trees to a trail along the nearby Trinity River. "Retailers are drawn to that kind of attraction," Mr. Montesi said. "People will pay for the experience." End of quote. The shrinkage could pose problems for retailers as well, by pushing up rents for existing space, sparking increased competition for prime locations, and forcing retailers to become more efficient about the space they use, according to analysts. "People will throw up their hands and say, 'We can't pay these rents,'" said Jesse Tron, a spokesman for ICSC. "That will spur retailers to ask developers to build more retail space," Mr. Tron said. "Even massive shopping centres such as Randall Park, Horvath, the Village's Randall, Ohio, are being reimagined." According to Charles, the Village's building commissioner, "People would come here from all over. There were more than 8,000 parking places, and during the holiday season, people would fight to get into them." End of quote. The mall closed during the recession amid increased competition from newer properties in the area. This year, developer Stuart Lichter and a partner tore down the mall, which they plan to replace with manufacturing sites and warehouse spaces for industrial customers. According to Mr. Lichter, "The country is just littered with obsolete real estate." John Frew, a developer based in Denver, is aiming to eliminate at least some of the excess. Mr. Frew took over the struggling Westdale Mall in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, in 2014, and the main mall building was demolished earlier this year. The new Westdale will include a hotel and offices, as well as space for people to walk around the property, said Mr. Frew. New stores have already started to open at the mall, and when the project is complete, there will be about a third less retail space than there was before. According to Mr. Frew, quote unquote, "We think it fits the market." Well, here's a quick word about Brazil. One of the truest aphorisms in the world of investing is that Brazil is the country with the most potential, and always will be. There are few other countries on the planet blessed with such an abundance of resources: fertile land, plenty of water, a huge population, incalculable mineral and natural resource wealth, and much more besides. And yet, Brazil can't ever seem to get out of its own way to realize this potential. Don't get me wrong, I really like Brazil. I've lived there for several years, and I've worked there. The people are charming. They are among the friendliest, most welcoming, and fun-loving on the planet. I'm also drawn to diversity. All races and ethnicities exist here, so it doesn't matter what hue your skin tone is. In Brazil, everyone blends in. That, by the way, makes it a fantastic country to obtain a second passport. After a few years of residency, it's possible to become a naturalized Brazilian citizen and actually look the part. One additional and potentially convenient benefit is that Brazil, by tradition, does not extradite its citizens abroad. So this country is a unique escape hatch. It's also tremendously exciting to be there. Brazil is modern and chic, and the allure of so many possibilities is undeniable. But there's a huge dark side to the place. Brazil is notorious for rampant corruption, regulation, and taxation that turns simple basic tasks into unimaginably mind-numbing challenges. The chaos and disorder is now reflected in Brazil's economic strife. The official numbers say that Brazil's economy has contracted 4.5%. If you happen to be there on the ground, you see immediately it's obviously much worse. Brazil is so broke that local officials recently decided to charge athletes for air conditioning at next year's Olympic Games in Rio. They then reversed the decision days later when they said they had found the money. That story pretty much tells you everything you need to know. Incompetence, corruption, and indecision all rolled into one. Yes, Brazil is a major oil exporter, so clearly cheap oil is having a major impact. But Brazil's woes aren't just about oil. They're about an entire country perpetually being unable to get its act together. One major factor is a bread and circuses brand of socialism that currently boasts more than 50 million people on government benefits. There are staples like food and rent subsidies, plus more advanced European-style welfare like free public universities and public hospitals. The list goes on and on. Naturally, this massive welfare state is matched by an astonishing tax burden. In fact, creating new taxes seems to be a national sport in Brazil, where an average of 46 new rules are added to the tax code each day. One Brazilian attorney took it upon himself to compile the country's tax code. It took him 23 years to do so, and the finished product weighed 7 whole tons. Even then, he only managed to track up to 2007 because he just couldn't keep up with the rate of increase. Such a vast, complex tax system obviously requires an even more vast, more complex bureaucracy to administer it, giving legions of bosses and bureaucrats the opportunity to plunder taxpayer resources. All of these problems are related. Corruption is enabled by the bureaucracy, and the bureaucracy is mandated by a socialist system designed to keep the corrupt in power. This system plagues and debilitates Brazil's economy, making it nearly impossible to come anywhere close to realizing its potential. Whenever I'm in Brazil, I think of Paul Krugman, who famously tells critics of bloated European welfare states that they should go on a forced walking tour of Stockholm. Aside from the intellectual offence of Mr. Krugman, believing he can force anyone to do anything, it is worth examining this fantasy of Scandinavian socialism. Sometimes it seems the entire world is obsessed with the idea of becoming Norway, filled with a false belief that massive government bureaucracy creates wealth. This notion is totally wrong. And if Norway fanatics ever cracked open a history book, they'd find out that Scandinavian nations became among the wealthiest economies in the world during the early 20th century, when they had minimal taxes and minimal government. Scandinavia has a long tradition in self-reliance, economic independence, and political minimalism. It was among the only regions in Europe that didn't go down the path of serfdom and feudalism. So in a way, Scandinavia was the America before the United States, and certainly built its wealth by being more like the way the United States used to be. But even still, more and more people, like Bernie Sanders, believe that the path to prosperity is in creating more government, more social welfare, and more taxes. And they think that by following some sort of magical recipe, they'll become Norway. That's the fantasy. The reality is that they turn into Brazil, chaotic, corrupt, and weak. Well, one of the major themes of the wake-up call is that major Western governments are flat broke. This is not the first time that a major world power has gone bankrupt, and we need only to look to history to see the consequences. Thousands of years ago, as Rome's bleak financial condition deteriorated, it didn't create a crisis all at once. Initially, the empire was able to limp along by debasing the currency and diluting the value of people's money. But eventually, that was no longer enough. So the government tactics became worse. They started imposing more severe taxes, imposing austere wage and price controls, and eventually began confiscating people's assets altogether. Rome's government did whatever it took to remain in power and maintain the status quo for a little while longer, no matter what. We've seen this over and over again throughout history, enough times to recognize that when superpowers go broke, it is not a consequence-free environment. It's happening again today. Some modern examples are comical, such as the United Kingdom's new task force to crack down on strippers and prostitutes who are suspected of not paying enough tax. I'm sure there's probably a lengthy queue of bureaucrats hoping to get assigned to the case. A few weeks ago, the Greek government started demanding its taxpayers report their holdings, gold, jewellery, and even cash stashed under their mattresses. Unreal. But the biggest example is, go figure, the land of the free. Over the weekend, when the media was terrifying Americans with stories of violent Muslims, the President of the United States quietly signed H.R. 22 into law. I told you about this bill a few weeks ago. Buried deep within its 400-plus pages is a provision giving the government the authority to revoke your passport if they believe in their sole discretion that you have what they describe as seriously delinquent tax debt. When I first told you about this, back in late November, it hadn't yet become law. So there was still some small chance that freedom and sanity would prevail. Well, freedom and sanity did not prevail. So this provision is now officially law and will be formally codified in section 7345 of the Internal Revenue Code. There's no judge, no trial. It's a simple administrative procedure. Like that. Poof! You can be stripped of your passport. But if you think that's vile, here's the craziest part. They actually included a nifty little get-out-of-jail-free clause for the government officials who are involved in the process. Section 7345, subsection E3, states that, quote, "The Secretary of the Treasury, the Secretary of State, and any of their designees shall not be liable to an individual for any action with respect to a certification by the Commissioner of Internal Revenue under Section 7345. End of quote. In other words, if they screw up and revoke your passport due to some bureaucrat flunky's Excel mistake, you're not allowed to take action and hold them responsible. I find this incredible. A bankrupt government has just awarded itself even more power to destroy people's freedom in the name of plundering wealth from the citizens. They made it happen quietly over a weekend when everyone was distracted with a violent shooting. And they made sure to include specific language to keep themselves from being held accountable for their mistakes. If you still think the government is there to protect and support you, it's time to take a hard look at reality. And the past, for that matter. In the 3rd century AD, Emperor Caracalla of the bankrupt Roman Empire infamously pointed to his sword and remarked, quote, "As long as we have this, we shall not run short of money." End of quote. That's precisely where we are today. These people are flat broke, and you are nothing but a dairy cow to them, locked in a pasture to be milked dry as they slide further into bankruptcy. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not some wild conspiracy theory. This is their own law, one that they passed when you weren't looking. Their own numbers show that they are bankrupt, and that the trust funds they're managing on your behalf for programs like Social Security and Medicare are either underfunded or out of cash. Simply put, they need the money. Your money. And this is not a zero-risk, consequence-free environment. It's time for any rational person to have a plan B. After all, you won't be worse off for taking sensible steps that ensure you don't have all of your eggs in one very fragile basket. But if these consequences continue to play out, as they have so many times throughout history, a good plan B means that you'll be a spectator instead of a victim.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
So, I'm going to talk a little about how girls' aptitude varies with men's in school. I think most of you are probably aware that girls are in general outclassing boys in scholastic aptitude. but there's more to it than meets the eye. According to Sir Anthony Seldon, the master of Wellington College, a posh English boarding school, and I quote, "It's all to do with their brains and bodies and chemicals," end of quote. According to Ivan Yip, principal of the Bronx Leadership Academy in New York, quote, "There's a mentality that it's not cool for them to perform, that it's not cool to be smart," end of quote. One school charges $38,000 a year and has a scuba diving club. The other serves subsidized lunches to most of its pupils, a quarter of whom have special needs. Yet both are grappling with the same problem. Teenage boys are being left behind by girls. It's a problem that would have been unimaginable a few decades ago. Until the 1960s, boys spent longer and went further in school than girls and were more likely to graduate from university. Now, across the rich world and in a growing number of poor countries, the balance has tilted the other way. Policymakers who once fretted about girls' lack of confidence in science now spend their time dangling copies of Harry Potter before surly boys. Sweden has commissioned research into what it calls its boy crisis. Australia has devised a reading program called Boys, Blokes, Books and Bites. In just a couple of generations, one gender gap has closed, only for another to open up. The reversal is laid out in a report published on March the 5th by the OECD, a Paris-based rich country think tank. Boys' dominance just about endures in math. At age 15, they are, on average, the equivalent of 3 months' schooling ahead of girls. In science, the results are fairly even. But in reading, where girls have been ahead for some time, a gulf has appeared. In all 64 countries and economies in the study, girls outperform boys. The average gap is equivalent to an extra year of schooling. The OECD deems literacy to be the most important skill that it assesses, since further learning depends on it. Sure enough, teenage boys are 50% more likely than girls to fail to achieve basic proficiency in any of math, reading, and science. Youngsters in this group, with nothing to build on or shine at, are prone to drop out of school altogether. To see why boys and girls fare so differently in the classroom, first look at what they do outside it. The average 15-year-old girl devotes 5.5 hours a week to homework, an hour more than the average boy who spends more time playing video games and trawling the internet. 3/4 of girls read for pleasure, compared with little more than half of boys. Reading rates are falling everywhere as screens draw eyes from pages, but boys are giving up faster. The OECD found that among boys who do as much homework as the average girl, the gender gap in reading fell by nearly a quarter. Once in the classroom, boys long to be out of it. They are twice as likely as girls to report that school is a quote-unquote waste of time and more often turn up late. Just as teachers used to struggle to persuade girls that science is not only for men, the OECD now urges parents and policymakers to steer boys away from a version of masculinity that ignores academic achievement. According to Mr. Yip, and I quote, "There are different pressures on boys. Unfortunately, there's a tendency where they try to live up to certain expectations in terms of bad behaviour," end of quote. Boys' disdain for school might have been less irrational when there were plenty of jobs for uneducated men. But those days have long gone. It may be that a bit of swagger helps in math, where confidence plays a part in boys' lead, though it sometimes extends to delusion. 12% of boys told the OECD that they were familiar with the mathematical concept of subjunctive scaling, a trick non-existent concept that fooled only 7% of girls. But their lack of self-discipline drives teachers crazy. Perhaps it's because they can be so insufferable that teenage boys are often marked down. The OECD found that boys did much better in its anonymized tests than in teacher assessments. The gap with girls in reading was a third smaller, and the gap in math, where boys were already ahead, opened up further. In another finding that suggests a lack of even-handedness among teachers, boys are more likely than girls to be forced to repeat a year, even when they are of equal ability. So let's have a look at what's behind this discrimination. One possibility is that teachers mark up students who are polite, eager, and stay out of fights, all attributes that are more common among girls. In some countries, academic points can even be docked for bad behaviour. Another is that women, who make up 8 out of 10 primary school teachers and nearly 7 in 10 lower secondary teachers, favour their own sex, just as male bosses have been shown to favour male underlings. In a few places, sexism is enshrined in law. Singapore still canes boys while sparing girls the rod. Some countries provide an environment in which boys can do better. In Latin America, the gender gap in reading is relatively small, with boys in Chile, Colombia, Mexico, and Peru trailing girls less than they do elsewhere. Awkwardly, however, this nearly always comes with a wider gender gap in math in favour of boys. The reverse is true too. Iceland, Norway, and Sweden, which have got girls up to parity with boys in math, struggle with uncomfortably wide gender gaps in reading. Since 2003, the last occasion when the OECD did a big study, boys in a few countries have caught up in reading, and girls in several others have significantly narrowed the gap in math. No country has managed both. Girls' educational dominance persists after school. Until a few decades ago, men were in a clear majority at university almost everywhere, particularly in advanced courses and in science and engineering. But as higher education has boomed worldwide, women's enrollment has increased almost twice as fast as men's. In the OECD, women now make up 56% of students enrolled, up from 46% in 1985. By 2025, that may rise to 58%. Even in the handful of OECD countries where women are in the minority on campus, their numbers are creeping up. Meanwhile, several, including America, Britain, and parts of Scandinavia, have 50% more women than men on campus. Numbers in many of America's elite private colleges are more evenly balanced. It is widely believed that their opaque admissions criteria are relaxed for men. The feminization of higher education was so gradual that for a long time it passed unremarked. According to Stéphane Vincent Lancrin of the OECD, when in 2008 it published a report pointing out just how far it had gone, people, quote-unquote, couldn't believe it. Women who go to university are more likely than their male peers to graduate and typically get better grades. But men and women tend to study different subjects, with many women choosing courses in education, health, arts, and the humanities, whereas men take up computing, engineering, and the exact sciences. In mathematics, women are drawing level. In the life sciences, social sciences, business, and law, they have moved ahead. Social change has done more to encourage women to enter higher education than any deliberate policy. The pill and a decline in the average number of children, together with later marriage and childbearing, have made it easier for married women to join the workforce. As more women went out to work, discrimination became less sharp. Girls saw the point of study once they were expected to have careers. Rising divorce rates underlined the importance of being able to provide for oneself. These days, girls nearly everywhere seem more ambitious than boys, both academically and in their careers. It is hard to believe that in 1900 to 1950, about half of all jobs in America were barred to married women. So, are women now on their way to becoming the dominant sex? Hannah Rosin's book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women, published in 2012, argues that in America, at least, women are ahead not only educationally, but increasingly also professionally and socially. Policymakers in many countries worry about the prospect of a growing underclass of ill-educated men. That should worry women too. In the past, they have typically married men in their own social group or above. If there are too few of those, many women will have to marry down or not at all. According to the OECD, the return on investment in a degree is higher for women than for men in many countries, though not all. In America PayScale, a company that crunches incomes data, they found that the return on investment in a college degree for women was lower than, or at best the same as, for men. Although women as a group are now better qualified, they earn about three quarters as much as men. A big reason is the choice of subject. Education, the humanities, and social work pay less than engineering or computer science. But academic research shows that women attach less importance than men to the graduate pay premium, suggesting that a high financial return is not the main reason for their further education. At the highest levels of business and the professions, women remain notably scarce. In a reversal of the pattern at school, the anonymous and therefore gender-blind essays and exams at university protect female students from bias. But in the workplace, says Elizabeth Kalem of Britain's Cranfield School of Management, traditional patterns assert themselves in miraculous ways. Men and women join the medical and legal professions in roughly equal numbers. But 10 to 15 years later, many women have chosen unambitious career paths or dropped out to spend time with their children. Meanwhile, men are rising through the ranks as qualifications gained long ago fade in importance and personality, ambition, and experience come to matter more. For a long time, it was said that since women had historically been underrepresented in university and work, it would take time to fill the pipeline from which senior appointments were made. But after 40 years of making up the majority of graduates in some countries, that argument is wearing thin. According to Claudia Goldin, an economics professor at Harvard, the last chapter in the story of women's rise, equal pay, and access to the best jobs will not come without big structural changes. In a recent paper in the American Economic Review, Ms. Goldin found that the difference between the hourly earnings of highly qualified men and their female peers grows hugely in the first 10 to 15 years of working life, largely because of a big premium in some highly paid jobs on putting in long days and being constantly on call. On the whole, men find it easier than women to work in this way. Where such jobs are common, for example in business and the law, the gender pay gap remains wide, and even short spells out of the workforce are severely penalised, meaning that motherhood can exact a heavy price. Where pay is roughly proportional to hours worked, as in pharmacy, it is low. There will always be jobs where flexibility is not an option, says Ms. Goldin. Those of CEOs, trial lawyers, surgeons, some bankers, and senior politicians come to mind. In many others, pay does not need to depend on being available all hours, and well-educated men who want a life outside work would benefit from change too. But the new gender gap is at the other end of the pay spectrum. And it is not women who are suffering, but unskilled men. Well, evidence that a completely new monetary policy ball game is commencing comes from Lord Keynes's current vicar on earth himself, none other than Larry Summers, who I spoke to you about a few weeks ago, if you may remember. A few days ago, he penned a strange op-ed in which he apparently reminded himself that the business cycle has not been outlawed, something most non-PhDs presumably already knew. US and international experience suggests that once a recovery is mature, the odds that it will end within 2 years are about half, and that it will end in less than 3 years are over two-thirds. Because normal growth is now below 2% rather than near 3%, as has been the case historically, the risk may even be greater now. While the risk of recession may seem remote, given recent growth, it bears emphasizing that since World War II, no post-war recession has been predicted a year in advance by the Fed, the White House, or the consensus forecast. Well now, if you wait until month 2078 of a business expansion to end the emergency policy, and then hesitate to venture more than a few basis points off the zero bound, you will indeed use up the remaining runway right quick. That's because the average of 10 business cycle expansions since 1948 have lasted but 61 months. Stretch of the 1990s, and the only expansion that was appreciably longer than the present tepid affair was the 119-month 20 years ago. China was still a quasi-agrarian victim of Mao's destructive experiments in collective economics and state-generated famine, not today's towering red Ponzi. That is, it was irrelevant then, but is now a bloated economic whale sinking under the weight of $30 trillion of debt and the most reckless spree of overinvestment and mindless public and private construction in recorded history. So as this domestic business expansion cycle gets long in the tooth, the US economy is confronted by a veritable engine of global deflation in the form of China and its emerging market supply chain. After a 20-year credit-driven boom, it is now payback time. All of these economies find their exports stalled, their exchange rates falling, and their debt service exploding higher. What this means, of course, is that Wall Street's decoupling myth will soon be on the scrap heap. US exports and imports are now crumbling, and even the standard measures of goods transit are cliff diving. According to Dr. Summers, the thing to do when recession strikes is to cut interest rates by 300 basis points. But even he admits it ain't gonna happen this time. Quote, even if it were technically possible to have a negative 300 basis point Fed funds rate, what is already a 2016 election year going gong show would take on a whole new level of crazy. The brutally trod upon savers and retirees of America would well and truly revolt. Historical experience suggests that when recession comes, it is necessary to cut interest rates by more than 300 basis points. I agree with the market that the Fed likely will not be able to raise rates by 100 basis points a year without threatening to undermine the so-called recovery. But even if this were possible, the chances are very high that recession will come before there is room to cut rates by enough to offset it. The knowledge that this is the case must surely reduce confidence and inhibit demand. Central bankers bravely assert that they can always use unconventional tools, but there may be less in the cupboard than they suppose. The efficacy of further quantitative easing in an environment of well-functioning markets and already very low medium-term rates is highly questionable. There are severe limits on how negative rates can become. A central bank that is forced back to the lower zero bound is not likely to have great credibility if it engages in forward guidance. So if the endlessly clever word splitter who currently heads the Church of Keynes on earth cannot do better than the aforementioned ill-disguised punt, can you imagine what blithering incoherence will be contained in the meeting statements as the recession gathers force next year? Oh yes, ladies and gentlemen, there will be a riot in the casino. Well, I'm sending a weekend reading to my email subscribers with all sorts of fascinating charts about millennials. I thought I'd just add a few things in advance of your reading enjoyment, and it's not a good story. Millennials are coming out of colleges, and have been for some time, with terrible education and no chance of working in their field of study. They're left leaning to the extreme, one might even say socialist on a large scale, and often anti-capitalist. That's exactly how the school system has trained them. Millennials are, for the most part, not individual thinkers. They've been trained to identify with the pack, something known to happen when children are removed early from their families and put in preschool, also known as pack training. They identify closely with the pack, so they're more easily deceived when caught up in their political ideology or in movements like the gay rights, green, or anti-gun movements. I don't believe that millennials are in the middle on anti-gun legislation. Of course, a lot of them have been to jail on drug charges, etc., so maybe that's who they're polling. Millennials care more for the planet than their industrial-trained grandparents and or their original cyber-generation parents. They are the backbone of all the green movements. Millennials often find themselves in a philosophical bind. They can't find jobs, and the industries they most distrust and or which despise them are the biggest employers: pharmaceutical, chemical, processed food, animal testing, or mass producing for food, defense, government, and the banks. Millennials, far more than their parents or grandparents, identify with poor immigrants because they have something important in common with them. Poor immigrants too have to struggle to make ends meet, and they also have been trained to believe in socialist policies of a right to healthcare, schooling, good housing, etc., regardless of whether they worked to deserve it. Furthermore, their lack of proper education puts them closer to the immigrant in that they don't have a thorough command of the English language, particularly in writing. And of course, they've been ingrained with the one world ideology. Millennials are making far less money than what they need to live, which explains all those men living at home with parents, and I would guess the number of women at home is much higher. A huge number of millennials who are not living at home are being subsidized by their parents due to not being able to make ends meet. It's not due to thoughtful planning that millennials are not having early families and buying homes. They are, for the most part, broke and can't afford families or homes. There's a huge division between the elite millennials, also known as rich and or brilliant grads coming out of colleges where they're immediately placed in very high-paying positions, and the masses struggling to find work. Most millennials have been coddled, hence their nickname, the Umbrella Generation. They don't have the gumption to keep plugging, working, thinking towards a goal. They have an unhealthy tendency to truly believe that they deserve things they haven't worked for, a side effect of American-style socialism. Millennials, more than any other generation, have no idea how finances work. They've been trained to go blindly into debt, and they seem to think all the social programs are there to be implemented for themselves and others, and funded by money the government finds growing on trees. Millennials have the reputation of being excellent employees if they join an organization and become part of the pack. Millennials are subject to depression because they are pack animals, and when they can't find a job that feels like a new pack and they don't have a solid family pack, they are easily lost. Therefore, more than any other young generation, they are on pharmaceutical drugs prescribed for any number of depression and confusion related symptoms. Once firmly addicted, they are very difficult to rebalance and get back on track. This means that there are lots of totally unemployable millennials out there. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of another show. I hope you've enjoyed it, maybe learnt a thing or three. And I will be back on Monday with another show. And until then, this is Richard Martin wishing you a wonderful weekend. Enjoy it, have at it, and be good. See you soon. Bye-bye.
And there you have it. You decide.